Ulysses S. Grant. Ulysses S. Grant was the son of a well-to-do tanner, Jesse Grant, of Georgetown, Ohio, and traced his ancestry backward through grandfather and great-grandfather, a Revolutionary and Colonial War fame, respectively, to the great clan of Scotland Grants, so distinguished throughout the centuries for their sturdy, indomitable traits and prowess in war. From the very first, Jesse Grant was absurdly proud of his firstborn. He talked so continuously of my Ulysses that his neighbors, who could see nothing at all wonderful about the sturdy, rather sluggish boy, beyond his unusual understanding and skill with horses, were disgusted, and comrades of Lysis felt called on to pay off the score. They had it in for him always, and life was not by any means a bed of roses for the little tanner boy. Besides the many battles which he was forced to fight for the maintenance of his dignity, he was obliged to put in long hours at the tannery. It was his business to break bark for the hopper of the bark mill, an occupation severely trying to a boy's soul, especially when pawpaws were ripe and fishing was prime. Young Lysis hated the tanner, shed prison house, with all his grand vim, and escaped whenever it was possible to do so by honorable means. He was too loyal to the firm principles of his mother, and too much in awe of his father's stern but just rule, to play truant. He sought diligently for other work that he might hire a boy in his stead. Sometimes, also, he succeeded in persuading his sisters to help him by exalting the privilege, Tom Sawyer fashion, and by earnestly detailing the need there was of his riding the sweep behind the horse. This was the first outcropping of the great generalship which was to appear in later years. Young Lysis scored his first strong triumph over apparent insurmountable difficulties when but 12 years of age. His father sent him to the woods after a load of logs, expecting the mill hands to help him make up his load. On arriving at the woods, the lad found plenty of logs, but no men. He was too impatient to wait, and too self-reliant to seek help. He looked about until he found a fallen tree, one end of which was lying on the stump about the height of his woodcart from the ground. Unhitching his team, he drew his logs one by one up the side of the prostrate tree until all he wanted were in the right position. Then, backing his cart under the load, and again making good use of his team and chain, he was soon able to drive off triumphantly, with no thanks to anyone. On a certain day, some years later, it happened that there was a shortage of hands at the tannery, and Mr. Grant ordered Ulysses to help him in the beam room. This was the most repulsive place in all the tannery, where the reeking hides were scraped and hung. So far, the lad had escaped work there. Now he faced his father bravely. "Father," he said firmly, "you know this tanning business is not to my liking. I'll work at it, though, if you say so, until I'm 21. But you may depend upon it, I will never work a day at it after that." Mr. Grant was very reasonable and judicious in some ways. He saw the folly of training the lad in a business which would never interest him. So he replied at once, "My son, you need never work again in the tannery unless you choose. I want you to work at whatever you like and intend to follow. What do you wish to be?" "A farmer, a down-the-river trader, or a college professor?" Observed the father, looking keenly at the boy, whom a traveling phrenologist had jokingly said might one day be president of the United States. "The little farm which you have been working is rented out. I have not the capital to set you up on a large scale. I have little respect for the river traders. Besides, I doubt if you have the ability to thrive in competitions of enterprise and greed. Nor do I see how I can send you to school. Times are hard, and an education costs considerable money. How would you like West Point? Education is free there, and the government supports the cadets." This latter was added merely as a happy afterthought. Though believing firmly in his boy's future greatness, the father had never dreamed of military glory for him. He had not taken into account the blood of fighting ancestors which coursed in his veins, nor the magic in the name Ulysses, which has ever been linked with strategies and prowess in war. Why not? The lad questioned himself quickly. He had never thought of a military life either, but it offered a release from the tannery and the road to an education, which was then the highest notch in his boyish ambition, and he grasped it eagerly. His appointment came at the age of 17, and he was graduated in due time from the famous academy without giving any promise of distinction. Indeed, one of his comrades styled him a very uncle-like sort of youth, with little enthusiasm in anything. He was modest, good-natured, respectful, companionable, observant, willing, and trusty. No mean list of virtues when weighed calmly. He was also proud of his good name and capable of resenting any insults to his origin or his former occupations. We read in The Tanner Boy that he considered the calling of tanner or farmer as honorable as any other in the world, and that he had resolved to thoroughly tan the hides of any cadets who showed a disposition to dispute it. Moreover, U.S. Grant knew no such word as can't. The story is told that he once laughed at a fellow student who said he could not learn a lesson. "Why, Tom," said he, "there is no such word as can't in the dictionary. I've examined the seas through and through, and there is no such word there." "Well," queried Tom, "what of that?" "Simply this," answered Grant. "I do not believe in a word that is not in the dictionary. I believe the lesson can be learned, and I'm going to try to learn it." The reply to this was a sneer, for young Grant was not a particularly bright pupil. But he had something more necessary than keen wit and brightness of perception. He had patience and courage and a determination to win. Of course he learned the lesson. When he came to command men and they hesitated at his orders or expressed doubts of their ability to comply, he always responded promptly, "The work must be done. There is no such word as can't in the dictionary. Let us try at least." Grant saw service as first lieutenant under General Scott in the Mexican War, where he acquitted himself with credit. At its close, he married Miss Julia Dent of St. Louis and was assigned to duty in the garrison at Sackett's Harbor. Later, he was transferred to Detroit and finally ordered to the Pacific Coast, where he rose to the rank of captain. At the age of 32, he resigned from the army and moved his family to a little farm near St. Louis, which belonged to his wife. The next 7 years were spent unsuccessfully on the farm, and as a dull clerk in the hide and leather business of his brothers at Galena, Illinois. The bright hopes which Jesse Grant had early entertained for his son now seemed hopeless indeed. Ulysses was seemingly dead to all ambition and utterly discouraged by the plight of hard conditions. Had he died before the summer of 1861, says Allen, at the age of 42, he would have filled an obscure grave, and those to whom he was dearest could not have esteemed his life successful, even in its humblest scope. He had not yet found his opportunity. He had not yet found himself. Lincoln's call for 75,000 troops was to Grant as a magician's wand, for presto, useless Grant was such no longer. He was charged with activity, efficiency, and confidence in his own ability. 5 months after leaving the counter at Galena, he electrified Congress and the nation at large by seizing Paducah at the mouth of the Tennessee without orders or suggestions from anyone. It was the act of a soldier and a statesman, for it not only secured the control of the two great rivers, Ohio and Tennessee, but preserved Kentucky to the Union. Before 6 months followed, he had captured Fort Donelson and 15,000 men. It was the first important success of the war and turned fortune's tide in favor of the Union. Moreover, it was accomplished without direct orders from his superiors. Indeed, General Halleck, Grant's immediate superior, is said to have considered defeat impossible with such forces as Grant had at his command. Grant was rewarded by being made Major General, and the country rang with cheers for Unconditional Surrender Grant, the new title having come from Grant's curt note in reply to General Buckner's plea for a committee to arrange terms of capitulation. No terms except an unconditional and immediate surrender can be accepted. I propose to move immediately upon your works. Like all men who achieve greatness, General Grant was forced to bear false accusations. Within 2 weeks after the capture of Fort Donelson, Halleck reported Grant remiss in his duties and so much addicted to drink that it was unsafe to entrust him with military plans. The charge arose partly from Halleck's dislike of Grant and partly from false reports which he had received concerning Grant's drinking to excess and the failure through the treachery of a telegraph operator false to the Union to forward Grant's reports to Halleck concerning his movements. McClellan, then commander-in-chief, authorized Halleck to place Grant under arrest. For several weeks a cloud hung over him, and his army was sent along the Tennessee under another command. Grant felt the mortification intensely, in spite of the fact that an effort for justice was at once set on foot by his friends. He declared that he would never wear a sword again. General Sherman, however, persuaded him to a different view, and when censure was removed, Grant resumed his old command. Presently, Halleck was raised to the dignity of commander-in-chief. Grant, as next in rank, was placed at the head of the Western Army. Here, the Tanner boy found himself in command of 60,000 men, and the pressure of his responsibility so spurred his faculties that people were amazed at his extraordinary nature. He was a mystery whom none could solve. A soldier especially fitted for command, undisturbed by danger, immutable in resolve, ready for responsibility, sustained in energy. The greater the emergency, the more absolutely his nature responded, and yet, like many men of genius, he was positively inefficient outside of his proper sphere. Hercules himself was not good at the distaff, nor Pegasus at the plow. On his 42nd birthday, Grant was commander-in-chief of the National Army of some 500,000 soldiers. The position of lieutenant general had been created expressly for him. In May 1864, he began that long series of battles, marches, sieges, and campaigns in which he controlled the armies of Sheridan, Thomas, Meade, and Sherman, and which at last ended in the surrender of Lee's army at Appomattox. General Adam Badeau, a member of Grant's staff, writes, "Nothing in Grant's whole career redounds more to the credit of his head as well as his heart than the terms he granted Lee. To impose no humiliation, to inflict no penalties on his defeated countrymen, was political wisdom of the highest order. And these terms were Grant's alone. The North was surprised at them. Lincoln did not suggest them. Andrew Johnson at first disapproved them. Congress would certainly not have suggested them. But at Appomattox, the victor dictated to the North as well as to the South. His countrymen accepted on that day whatever he who had done so much for them in the past considered wise for them in the future, and the possibility of another rising of the South was averted forever. No Richelieu or Bismarck, by one superlative stroke of statesmanship, ever achieved on a single day so much for his country. No act of Lincoln or Washington was more beneficent to the nation or more important to mankind than this far-reaching grasp of patriotism with which Grant brought back the beaten, broken Confederacy into the Union. The peace that he there secured was a greater glory than the victories that he won." Grant left the army with the most friendly feeling in his heart for the South. It was his desire quickly to reestablish perpetual peace and harmony with that enemy whose manhood, however mistaken the cause, drew forth such Herculean deeds of valor. In these sentiments, Lincoln fully concurred, but alas, His cruel assassination sadly blocked the way and well-nigh wrung the heart of the general, who hurried from Philadelphia to give his hearty support to the misguided Johnson. During the conflict between the President and Mr. Stanton, General Grant, much against his inclination, served as Secretary of War for 5 months and was thereby plunged into a battle of politics as fierce as any he had fought in the field. Here he restrained the hottest spirits on both sides and altogether displayed such calm judgment and statesmanship that for a long time the South looked upon him as their most powerful friend. They could not forget his magnanimity at Appomattox. A few days before his 47th birthday, the Tanner son fulfilled the long-cherished hopes of his father. He became President of the United States, filling the office for 2 successive terms. He was an able and patriotic ruler whose firmness and high sense of duty and honor restored peace and honor at home and made the United States respected and honored abroad. On his tour around the world, which followed his retirement from office, he was everywhere met by the most flattering demonstrations. The Prince of Wales welcomed him. Queen Victoria received him and Mrs. Grant as her guests at Windsor Castle. The cities of London, Edinburgh, and Glasgow tendered to him their freedom. At Cairo, he was royally entertained by the Khedive. At Constantinople, the Sultan gave him a warm reception. At Rome, Pope Leo XIII and King Humbert extended to him kindly greetings. At Berlin, he had a most cordial meeting with Bismarck. At St. Petersburg, Vienna, and Madrid, he was received by the sovereigns. The King of Siam placed a palace at his disposal. At Canton, the Chinese viceroy had prepared the people for the advent of the King of America. At Tokyo, the emperor received him with singular warmth. On his return to America, the great military hero entered the trade arena as the private partner of a Wall Street broker, hoping thus to swell his inadequate fortune of $100,000. Luck favored him. In 2 years, his wealth increased tenfold. He became a millionaire. For the first time in his life, he had a bank account which he was not afraid of overdrawing. Fortune, however, was not disposed long to smile upon him. Within a week of his 62nd birthday, through the machinations of his partner, General Grant became bankrupt. He at once gave up everything he had in the world, even the presents which admiring countrymen and foreign potentates had lovingly presented to him. Then, in spite of the protests of loyal friends and the disease which fastened upon him, he began the writing of his personal memoirs, with which he hoped to secure a competence for his family. "Nothing," says one of the biographers, "can be imagined more unacceptable to General Grant's native disposition than the narration for the public of his own life story." But in his circumstances, the question was not one of sentiment, but only of duty to those who were dependent upon him. The task was undertaken resolutely, and in spite of physical weakness and suffering, was carried on with as high and faithful energy as he had shown in any campaign of the war. On March 3, 1885, he was restored to the army with the rank of general on the retired list, with full pay. He was glad, but in his feebleness, joy was as hard to bear as grief. He began failing more rapidly. "In June," writes Allen, "he was taken to the sweet tonic air of a cottage on Mount McGregor near Saratoga. Here, in pleasant weather, he could sit in the open air and enjoy the agreeable prospect. But whether indoors or out, he toiled at the book at every possible moment, writing with a pencil on tablets while he had the strength, then dictating in almost inaudible whispers, little by little, to his secretary. So toilsomely, through intense suffering, sustained by an indomitable will, this legacy to his family and the world was completed to the end of the war. His last battle was won. 4 days after the victory, he died, July 25, 1885. The book had a success beyond all expectations, and accomplish the purpose of its author. To his countrymen, it was a revelation of the heart of the man, Ulysses Grant, in its nobility, its simplicity, and its charity, that has endeared him beyond any knowledge afforded by his outward life. During his last days, the general was inexpressibly comforted by the kind messages which poured in from all over the world, from people of all nationalities, of all religions and of no religion, of Confederate and national troops alike. When he was no more, unlimited condolences poured from the same source to the bereaved family. His body lay in state for 3 days at the City Hall in New York. Then a magnificent funeral cortege, the most imposing ever seen in America, composed of 50,000 men in line, bore him away to his last resting place in Riverside Park, where those who had in bygone years struggled in deadly conflict now mingled their tears over the bier of the brave and patriotic soldier, the friend of the North and the South alike. Memorial services were held throughout the country from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and even in Westminster Abbey, that the world might pay tribute to the great and good man, who, though a warrior, loved peace, and who, could he have witnessed his own funeral, would probably have voiced again the sentiments of General Buckner, who surrendered to him at Fort Donelson, and who was one of the pallbearers in the last sad rites. We may now well look forward to a perpetual peace at home, and a national strength that will screen us against any foreign complication. I believe myself that the war was worth all it cost us, fearful as that was. Over his tomb, this simple epitaph is inscribed, "Let us have peace."